themselves as being more in the middle have been alienated. So they don't want to say that they're one or the other. In fact, the authors argue that the parties have really positioned themselves in a way that it's next to impossible for them to advocate a kind of centrist agenda, which is what they say that they are doing in this book, The Radical Center. So as we talk, of course, questions, comments are welcome. I expect some people will either want to agree or disagree or maybe take issue with some of what the guest has to say, and that's great. All we ask, though, of callers is that people are brief in their comments so that we can keep things moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But anybody's welcome to join us. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. And if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. We'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL. That's what you get if you match the numbers and the letters. And toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Lind, hello.
Yes.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. Maybe just for a moment, just to start in 25 words or less, tell us about the New America Foundation. What is your orientation there and your kind of agenda?
Well, it's the most talked about new think tank in Washington. We mostly have fellows in their 20s and 30s and 40s. We try to go beyond the old familiar liberal and conservative worldviews. To look at things from high tech to reinventing Social Security from a broadly centrist perspective.
Hmm. Let's talk about where now we are in politics, and maybe you can amplify a little bit more on this idea that you write about in the book, and that is why it is that it seems that an awful lot of people feel estranged from the two major parties and now in increasing numbers don't want to identify with one or the other.
Well, if you look at the polling data from the last election, it's quite remarkable. According to some polls, more than 50% of the public said that they were independents or moderates and did not identify either with the right or the left, or for that matter, with the Democrats or Republicans. Ted Halstead and I in the Radical Center argue that Americans are quite right to be disaffected with the two parties who are still battling over issues that are 30 or some cases 50 or 75 years old. Liberalism tends to be defined in terms of defending the entitlements that were created during the New Deal period from the 30s to the 60s, many of which, like Social Security and Medicare, are very good things, but they radically need to be reinvented to deal with the new fiscal and demographic realities of the 20th century. So it's not enough, 21st century. So it's not enough simply to keep defending these half-century-old programs. They have to be reinvented. Many conservatives are nostalgic for this period before the New Deal, in which there was a very small, tiny government in the United States. That's never coming back again. In an advanced high-tech society with social insurance, there's going to be a major federal role in the economy and the society, and that's permanent. The conservatives have not yet adapted to this. So we argue not for the squishy center, not for splitting the difference, as many politicians do, between the familiar Republican and Democratic positions, but for a third alternative, for a new agenda, and we call that agenda the Radical Center.
Mm-hmm. I guess, and I'm not trying to pick a fight here, but having, and we can talk in some detail, but I guess having looked at the issues and considered what seems to be the spectrum of thought in America, I think that you're to the right of center. It doesn't look to me like it's exactly in the center.
It was kind of amusing because in our reviews, Michael Kazin in the New York Observer, a left liberal publication, said the ideas in our book were all great ideas, but these guys are fooling no one. They're really trying to reinvent liberalism. then Daniel Kass in Commentary, a right-wing magazine, said, you know, these are terrific ideas, but these guys are basically Republicans and they should stop pretending. It depends on the issues. For example, we take a what might be conventionally more conservative line on Social Security. We think that there's a room for private investment accounts. We agree with the president's commission on that. On the other hand, when it comes to K through 12 education, we put forth the most radically left-wing proposal, you might call it, for the finance of education in American history. We call for national equalization of school funding. We'd prefer to see that in connection with some degree of choice, whether within the public school system like charter schools or a complete school choice system. But we think that the movement within the states in the 1980s and 1990s for intra-state equalization of funding among school districts within a state The next step beyond that is to get rid of these grotesque disparities in K through 12 financing between states. For example, Mississippi spends an average of $4,000 per student. New Jersey spends $12,000 per student. That's even adjusting for the price of living differences between the two states. So on some issues, we may look more left. On others, we may look more right. But we don't think in those categories. We're trying to look at this on a case-by-case basis from the point of view of our philosophy, which seeks to reconcile fairness, which has traditionally been the strength of American liberalism, with flexibility, which traditionally has been the strength of American libertarianism and conservatism.
Well, and I suppose what all of this, the reaction to your book, obviously what all that suggests is that there is some, that there's marginal utility in the terms conservative and liberal, because they do intend, in some sense, to be relative. That is, you know, somebody else, if you decide, are they conservative or liberal? Well, it also has something to do with what you think you are, and you know, so maybe it betrays my political bias. So I say it looks like you guys are a little bit to the right of the center.
Well, but if you look at the polls, only about 10% of Americans will describe themselves as liberal. Very small number. The number who describe themselves as, you know, really rigorously left is a mere fraction of that. About twice that many Americans, so usually about 20%, sometimes 25-30%, depending on the poll, will call themselves conservatives. So if you add up those two groups, liberals and conservatives, you have a clear majority of Americans who do not feel comfortable with either term. Hmm.
One thing that intrigues me that you also talk about in the book is that you suggest that this kind of the place that we are now, we've been there before in the past in American politics, and that it seems to come at times of great technological change.
Well, in our book, The Radical Center, Ted Halstead and I argue that the United States has been reinvented twice before, once during the Civil War and Reconstruction, when Lincoln and his successors transformed the country and moved it from an agrarian society into a successful industrial society. And then during the Second Industrial Revolution of electricity and cars and hydroelectric power, in which Franklin Roosevelt and his New Deal successors between the 30s and the 1960s and 70s transformed America once again and created a suburban service sector society. And we're still living in the New Deal era. It's kind of falling apart from old age. It's sort of like a great mansion, which at one time was very new and shiny, and now it just needs to be renovated seriously. So we argue that there will be a third reinvention of the United States, of not only the institutions of government, but also those of the marketplace and of the private civil society. At some point in this century, probably in the next few decades, or at least the next couple of generations, what happens historically with these reinventions is that a lot of good ideas for necessary reforms pile up in ordinary times, but in peacetime and in times of ordinary politics, the forces of resistance of the status quo tend to defeat reform ideas, and then there's some huge crisis. Sometimes it's a domestic crisis like the Great Depression, but often it's a military crisis like the Civil War or World War II. It opens the floodgates, and so a lot of these ideas that have been dammed up for decades or generations are enacted fairly quickly. People forget that while he was fighting the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln pushed through all sorts of things, from a tariff policy that promoted industrialization, the railroadization of the West, land-grant colleges, a lot of good ideas that had nothing either to do with secession or with slavery, but that laid the foundation for what we call the Second Republic of the United States. Franklin Roosevelt and his successors, like Harry Truman and John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, enacted a lot of ideas ranging from Social Security to federal aid for education, which had been floating around since the early 1900s, if not from the late 19th century. But before the crises of the Depression and World War II and the Cold War, politicians favoring these reforms could not prevail over those with a vested interest in the status quo. So our purpose in the Radical Center is not to predict what's going to happen in the next couple of congressional cycles. It's to set forth the broad philosophical outlines of an agenda which in the next decade or in the next generation could serve as the basis for a new American politics.
Hmm. We have a couple of callers. Let me introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Michael Lind. He is currently a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, a think tank in Washington. He has previously been either editor or staff writer in a number of publications, The New Yorker, Harper's, and The National Interest. He's also written for others, including New York Times Magazine and Atlantic Monthly. He is the co-author of a recently published book. It's titled The Radical Center, the subtitle The Future of American Politics. Doubleday is the publisher. And we have some callers, and we'd certainly welcome people into the conversation. You want to agree, disagree, make whatever point you like. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a couple of people here ready to go. We'll start with line one. Hello.
Hi there. Where to start? The copy that was read to introduce, I don't know if this is from the fellow's intro or something, or whether it's something was written at WLL, but it says that the Democratic and Republican Party have been taken over their extremes.
That's the opinion of the guest. I just want to state that that's not
that's,
me.
That's not your copy. Okay. That is his opinion.
Yes.
What is the Democratic Leadership Council? What do you make of the fact that when Clinton was governor of Arkansas, he was collaborating with Reagan on so-called welfare reform? You know, this is absurd. The Democrats have been taken over so that they're not a second party. That's why there's so many independents. There's no choice. I'm sure you've heard this before, and you probably, you know, in your Washington think tank, you're finally honing your arguments, et cetera, and parry this one quite well and say I'm old and in the way, but, you know, some things don't change. I don't know if you're old enough to remember when Reagan was president, he had a very high popularity rating, but then when a good polling company polled people on his, policies, most people disagreed with him. 70% of the people in this country were favoring a universal health care plan along the lines of Canada, where you have choice, and it's not like the health system in Britain, though that's actually still better in a lot of ways than the one here, as far as getting more care to more people, until Thatcher started crucifying it. But so that's the point. I think you're making very safe and marketable sorts of arguments in the current climate, but you can start with telling me what role you see the Democratic Leadership Council having in the Democratic Party, and how the Democratic leisure class, as we've been calling it here.
Well, that's Mr. Lind. What do you think?
Well, you know, I sympathize with your caller. I'm afraid he's part of a small and marginal minority of people on the left in this country. You know, people who think that there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans and think that the Democrats are too right-wing make up, you know, 1 or 2% of the population. As I said, about 10% of the public in polls, and this is consistent, these are polls, you know, by left and right, say that they're liberal, and the vast majority of those are sort of moderate liberals. You know, the number of people who think of themselves as democratic socialists or as social democrats in the European sense are truly minuscule, and so I just, you know,
I don't need your sympathy, please. The point is that people have very, very communitarian policies when you ask them about it. They think everybody should have a right to health care
We put forth our own proposal in the Radical Center for universal portable health care. It's not a single-payer model, which we don't think is politically feasible in the United States. It's been tried multiple times.
Truman tried to introduce it after World War II.
So did Johnson, because the idea of Medicare was that after a few years, it would start off with old people, and then this would, you know, by the end of the 60s, would be the universal.
Yeah, and it was abandoned.
Medicine program.
The Great Society was abandoned. People think that it went on for decades. It's not true.
We do agree with proponents of single-payer that health care should be severed completely from your employer, and then it should be totally universal. One of the problems with our present employer-based health insurance system, as you know, is that it creates this two-tier labor market with a distinction between full-time workers and contingent workers. And, of course, much of the labor struggle in the 1990s, the UPS strike, for example, involved corporations. Microsoft did the same thing, trying to use contingent workers basically as scabs so that they wouldn't have to pay benefits.
Well, I don't know what's really radical about your center. I'm glad you're advocating that. But
On the other hand, what we're in favor of is a mandatory self-insurance with low-income people being subsidized by the government. This is a system that's used in Switzerland. It's used in Singapore. It's an alternative to this kind of centralized government-run Bismarckian.
Well, you're still dumping a lot of money, subsidized money, into the insurance industry, and they're still spending more money turning people down for care than they are giving care, and I know that extremely well. I'll let somebody else have a shot. Thanks.
All right. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I guess I don't want to belabor this point, but I still want to get the reaction to the to what the caller said about where the Democratic Party was now, because if indeed, as you say, people with his views are a small minority, and I guess I don't see how it is that, and I don't see any evidence of those people having much of a voice in the Democratic Party, certainly nothing that would parallel the voice that conservatives have in the Republican.
I disagree. If you look at Joe Lieberman, for example, who is a genuine, the Democratic Leadership Council, these are genuine centrists. That is, they've deliberately tried to be an alternative to the left wing of the Democratic Party, which is associated with an absolutely inflexible position on a public school monopoly of education, for example. They're, you know, the Democratic left is totally opposed to school choice in any sort that weakens the public teachers' unions, who make up about a fifth of the Democratic delegates to Democratic conventions. The Democratic left is rigidly in favor of very crude race-based and gender-based affirmative action programs. And the Democratic Leadership Council, to their credit, I think, has questioned a lot of these shibboleths of the Democratic left. They have not. They have managed to promote a number of their leaders, like Bill Clinton and Al Gore. However, when push comes to shove, when it comes to getting the Democratic nomination, all of these leaders have essentially had to abandon the DLC position and adopt those of the Jesse Jackson wing of the party, of the teachers' unions, and so on. And we saw this with Joe Lieberman, who abandoned one after another of his centrist positions in order to win the blessing of the Democratic left to get the Democratic nomination. So I think the DLC has tried to move the Democratic Party in a more moderate position. However, the fact that the nomination of Democratic candidates still depends very solidly on rather small interest groups, including public school teachers' unions, I think that shows that they failed to take it over. At most, they've made a few careers for a few politicians, but they're weaker, in my view, when it comes to the nominations. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the nominating process, and you see the same thing in the Republican Party. The vast majority of Republican voters are fairly middle of the road. So are a lot of Republican politicians. The activists who control the nominations are very, very hardline, dogmatic, economic conservatives and religious right fundamentalists. John McCain was the most popular politician in the country at one point last year. Probably easily could have won the presidency. He could never win the Republican nomination because the religious right opposed him and the far right opposed him in the nominating process. So we do think one of the reasons the American people are frustrated is that relatively small groups of activists who have their own familiar agendas stand between the general electorate, which tends to be fairly centrist. That is, it's somewhat to the right of the Democratic Party base and somewhat to the left of the Republican Party base. But politicians who share many of their views cannot get nominated because they're too right-wing for the Democratic primary activists and they're too left-wing for the Republican primary activists.
Well, let's go on. We have other callers. Let's go next to line number two. Next person in line. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning. Just so you know where I'm coming from a little bit, I kind of align myself more with green or natural capitalism, sort of in the vein of Paul Hawkins and Amory and Hunter Lovins.
Ted Halstead, my co-author, is an old ally and friend of theirs.
Okay. But, you know, I guess I find your premise, I'm very skeptical of the idea that, you know, that the Democrats have been captured by the left. And I would say that why so many people don't align themselves with either political party. And in fact, you know, half people don't even bother to participate at the consumer level of voting in the political process is because, and I think rightly so, they see both parties as truly aligning themselves with the interest of corporate elites and not really having their interest in, you know, in heart.
Well, that's true of some. There are obviously disaffected voters, including some of the supporters of Ralph Nader, for example, who think that the Democrats are not left-wing enough for their taste. They're a tiny minority of...
You're talking about people who are politically engaged. When you're talking about people who, you know, follow Nader, I'm saying that, you know, there's a whole lot more people. Half the population in this country of voting age doesn't even bother to go to the polls. They don't identify with the political process because they don't think that it really is doing anything in their interest.
Well, I agree with you entirely about this, and as a matter of fact, in the Radical Center, Ted and I propose a way to help that solve that problem, which we think is even more important than campaign finance reform, which we support very vigorously, but we don't think campaign finance reform is enough. We propose that the U.S., like most democracies in the world today, adopt some form of choice voting, also known as proportional representation, in which votes for third party and fourth party candidates are not wasted votes, as they are under our first past the post or winner take all electoral rule. For example, under our system, if you vote for Nader but you prefer Gore to Bush, then by voting for Nader you're basically helping Bush and hurting Gore. There's an alternate system called instant runoff voting, where in an election with more than two candidates, you can list the candidates in order of preference. For example, in the last election, if you have a Gore, Bush, Nader, you could put one or a two or a three next to each of their names. And then the candidate with the fewest votes gets eliminated, but the second choice votes of that candidate's voters are then reassigned instantly and mathematically by computers to the two remaining top candidates. It's exactly the same principle as a runoff election, but you don't have the runoff election 2 weeks or 6 weeks later, and you don't spend millions of dollars doing it, and people don't go back to the polls. You can do it all with the same ballot. And this is done, for example, to elect the President of the Republic of Ireland. It's used in Australia. It's on the ballot in San Francisco in March. They're having a ballot initiative as to whether to elect their city leaders by means of instant runoff voting. So we agree wholeheartedly with the idea that a lot of Americans find no candidates or no parties that represent their own particular mixture of concerns and issues. And in fact, that is, we argue in the book, The Radical Center, the primary reason for the alienation of American voters from voting is not because of corrupt campaign contributions and so on. That's a problem, to be sure, but, you know, corporations and rich individuals had much more corrupt control of the process in the old days than they do now, and yet people showed up for voting. The real problem is a lack of choice. That is, the two options that are offered again and again and again simply don't satisfy a growing number of the American people. And if you look in an international perspective, countries that have three-party and four-party systems have very, very high voter turnout. Countries that have stable two-party systems with winner-take-all rules, like the United States and Britain, have the lowest voter turnout in the world. So we think that instant runoff voting as a way of making votes for third-party candidates and also for independents would revitalize voting in America, and people would finally have a chance to say that my vote counts.
Well, I still think that money controls the choices that we have in politics more than anything else, and
Let me challenge you on that, though.
Just a second. I'd like to see how you're going to get the Democrats and the Republicans to agree to give up their monopoly on the process by allowing the system that would encourage third and fourth parties.
Well, look, it's simply not the case that billionaires and corporations can get their candidate, let's assume they have their candidate, their front man, elected anywhere in the United States. That's just not the case. Voters do count, and voters do have preferences, and these preferences vary among groups. You know, liberal interest groups could spend billions and billions of dollars And yet they cannot elect a liberal from a white conservative district in Mississippi, because it doesn't matter how much money you spend. You could spend countless amounts of money without electing a right-wing Republican, you know, from Berkeley. So there's limits. It's true that there's what Jamie Raskin calls the wealth primary, that is, the ability to raise funds, not only from rich individuals and corporations, but also from liberal interest groups, for example, like the unions, does weed out a lot of candidates who potentially would be very good candidates. And that's why we favor campaign finance reform and the quickest and simplest version of that that's most likely to work is free media access, particularly the broadcast media in television and radio, as a condition for TV and radio licenses. This is opposed violently by the telecom industry because it would lose a lot of advertising revenue. But we make the case that since this is a public service, or the access to the airwaves is given away conditionally to these profit-making corporations, they should be required to give equal time to everyone who's on the ballot anyway. And that could do more to break open public debate, and we get far more candidates who don't have to mortgage themselves to special interests, including liberal special interests like the teachers' unions or the AFL-CIO, in advance of getting nominated. However, having said that, money is not the only factor in American politics. I mean, religion is a factor. The country, the electorate is very polarized along racial lines. There are big regional differences, you know, between the two coasts and the Rocky Mountains and the South and the Midwest. So I just think reforming American politics, it can't be reduced simply to getting money out of the system. That's a first step, but it's not going to create a panacea.
Well, that's the first radical idea I've heard you present of free media, which I'm for the candidates, which I'm wholeheartedly in favor of. But once again, I'd like to see how you're going to get that passed. Well, thanks.
All right. Well, we're a little bit past the midpoint here of this show, and I want to, again, introduce our guest and get some more callers. We're speaking with Michael Lind. He is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, a Washington-based think tank. He's also been a writer, editor, staff writer for The New Yorker, Harper's, and The National Interest. He's also written for other publications. He's the co-author, along with Ted Halstead, who is president and CEO of the New America Foundation. They're the co-authors of this book we've mentioned. It's titled The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics. Doubleday is the publisher, in which he and his co-author make the argument, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, that the two parties have, in their terms of their leadership, their ideology, have embraced the extremes, leaving most voters somewhere in the middle, unwilling or unable to identify with either. That is why they would say that most people now identify themselves as independents more than identify as either Democrats or Republicans. And they lay out their idea for a new agenda in the book. So if you're interested, you can look at it. And, of course, questions, comments here are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next caller in line is on line three. Hello?
Oh.
Yes?
It seems to me that you're first caller.
It would really help us. I'm sorry, I don't mean to ask you to shout, but if you could speak up, because you're kind of faint.
All right. It must be partly the connection. It seems to me that your first caller put his finger on a problem with your thesis that only, I believe, 10% of the citizens consider themselves liberal. But I think this is more a matter of semantic loading than of opinion. If you, and this has been done, if you poll these same people for their political views, you find that a very large number actually hold liberal views, although they do not consider themselves liberal. And I think this is simply a matter of the assault upon the word liberal over the last 30 years or so, where it has come to be synonymous to many people, probably a majority of Americans, as communist.
Well, there's some truth to that, and you're exactly right, because when you break the issues down, most people, and again, we're not trying to suggest that the majority is necessarily right. I mean, the majority may be wrong about things, and minorities may be correct. But if you look at the biggest group in the American population tends to take fairly liberal views on economic matters, on things like the minimum wage, on social security. Security benefits being guaranteed, however they're provided, on spending for public education, that sort of thing. This doesn't necessarily help liberal Democrats, however, because the same group tends to be fairly conservative, or at least slightly to the right of center, on a lot of social issues, ranging from school prayer, which majorities favor, overwhelming majorities of white Americans, who are still some like 75% of the population, are deeply opposed to racial preferences when affirmative action is defined that way. There's been a consistent majority for 30 years in favor of substantial cuts in immigration.
Those are populist views rather than...
But I think that the largest single group in the electorate probably would fit into this populist category that's somewhat to the right of center socially and somewhat to the left of center economically, and it's not represented really in either of the two parties. You got sort of Pat Buchanan, you know, to a certain extent with the Republicans, and there used to be people like Tom Harkin and so on among the Democrats, but essentially the Democrats have become a consistently socially liberal, socially economically liberal party.
I think part of the problem in any political discussion is we've completely debased the term liberal in this country since the 1930s. I see a few Democrats on the, I hate to use the term, left wing, who are progressive liberals. I don't see any true leftists. And a majority of the remainder as being classical liberals.
Well, of course, liberal itself was kind of stolen by Franklin Roosevelt and the New Dealers from Herbert Hoover because, you know, Hoover
was a liberal, as was Taft.
Yeah, and so now we call the classical liberals libertarians. And liberal in the United States since the 30s has had two meanings. From the 30s to the 60s, it meant what in Europe would be called social democrat, you know, or essentially someone in favor of a substantial welfare state, a middle-class entitlement state, a social contract for an industrial society. And that was and remains very popular, that kind of liberalism, where you have a somewhat redistributionist social welfare state. It's more popular when the middle class gets the benefits than when poor people get the benefits, but it's still very popular. Then beginning with the new left in the 1960s and 1970s, a lot of identity politics issues, race, gender, sex, tended to define liberalism. And then you got a kind of cultural liberalism. So you're quite right. It's a very sticky term. And, you know, depending on who's speaking, you're talking in terms of this old 1930s economic liberalism, which means Social Security, Medicare, federal aid to education. Or, you know, it's the gay rights, pro-choice, you know, multicultural issues, which form a different complex that I'm calling cultural liberalism. But you see the same confusion on the right because there's the same distinction between the cultural or social conservatives,
right.
such as the religious right, many of whom are by no means economic libertarians. A lot of Baptists and Pentecostalists, if you look at the polls, hate big business and big banking just as much as people on the left do. They tend to be sort of William Jennings Bryan populists. And then on the other hand, you have the economic right, the so-called economic conservatives, many of whom are completely secular, you know, pro-gay rights, pro-choice when it comes to abortion, and they have purely an alliance of convenience with these populist religious right activists. So I think both liberalism and conservatism in modern American politics have this ambiguity between their economic aspects and their cultural aspects.
I would agree with your analysis there completely. The term conservative in this country is absolutely meaningless today because, as you point out, it's at least three groups, fundamentalist religion, traditional or classical liberals of the old school, and the real conservatives who were almost 100% Democrats 50 or 60 years ago.
Well, we argue in the radical center that the contemporary right really isn't so much conservative as counter-revolutionary. That is, they want to actually overthrow these two successful revolutions of the 1930s, which created the modern expanded federal government, and the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s, which led to feminism, to much greater social tolerance, racial integration, and so on. And so both the cultural conservatives and the economic conservatives tend to have a utopia which is really can never be recovered in the 21st century. You know, a lot of them want to go back to the Calvin Coolidge America of the 1920s in terms of economics, where there's a truly minimal federal government. The cultural conservatives, some of them, the more moderate ones, say they want to go back to the family values of the 1950s, which you just can't do in a society where the demography has been transformed by more independent elderly people, by the liberation of women from household work as their only option or menial clerical tasks. So we think this should satisfy you that we're not conservatives in disguise. We think the 21st century presents us with radically new social conditions as well as economic crises and technological opportunities. And we really should just think on a case-by-case basis, what are our goals? You know, we want old people to live in comfort and dignity. We don't want any child to be punished when it comes to education on the basis of residence or parental income. We want there to be no distinction between contingent workers and full-time workers so that if you lose your job, you should not lose your benefits. These are the goals. Now, Ted Halstead and I in the Radical Center have put forth certain proposals for reaching these that we think are the best, but you know, we're not the last word on this. You know, the methods are debatable, but I do think that we can have a consensus on what goals we want, and we can also have a consensus, and this would be more resisted by people defending the old order, saying that increasingly a lot of methods for reaching those goals, which once made sense, don't make sense anymore in current conditions. For example, Social Security made perfect sense as an intergenerational transfer program from young workers to retirees when there were 15 young workers for every one retiree. In the 21st century, and presumably in the 22nd and the 23rd, you know, the graying of America and other industrial democracies is a permanent shift. When you get societies like Germany and Japan and like the United States a few decades in the future where the median age is 40, and you know there's a ratio of one or two workers to every retiree, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, if he were alive today, would not have made Social Security a pure transfer program from young workers to retirees. You know, it just would have made no sense given today's conditions. So it's not that we're repudiating the work done by people we admire, like many of the New Dealers, including Republicans like Eisenhower, who were modern Republicans and accepted the changes that the New Deal wrought. We simply think that many of these good goals, these enduring values, have to be sought by new means.
We just have 10 minutes left. I hope the caller will forgive me for jumping in. The lines are full. I want to try to include some other folks in the time that we have left. Let me just real quick, again, introduce our guest. We're speaking with Michael Lind. He is the co-author, along with Ted Halstead, of the book The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, published by Doubleday. So if you're interested in learning more about how they see things, you go out and take a look at the book. We do have several people. We'll try to get in as many as we can. The next person in line is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed. You're the same fellow that spoke a few years ago about the overclass, and I really liked your take on current politics back then. To quote an article in the New York Times a couple years ago, you thought what's really going on is there's a university-trained professional overclass that has managed to suppress discussion of class conflicts that are as powerful as ever. And you say that disagreements over according to this reviewer, disagreements over so-called wedge issues, Mr. Lind maintains, are a ruse aimed at making the rest of the nation believe there's a debate going on. Two questions, one related to this and then another one on a separate issue. I was wondering, have you kind of abandoned ship on that concept entirely, or do you think that you know, that that kind of approach is just isn't going to work, or what is it? Have you refuted those ideas to your own mind, or what?
No, my book, The Next American Nation, in which I analyze the increasing power and authority of elite college-educated people in all aspects of American society, I stand by that analysis. I think it's been confirmed within both parties as the more populist or working-class-oriented wings of both parties have tended to wither away in the course of the 1990s. However, having said that, in 1995, it wasn't my purpose, and certainly wasn't my co-author's purpose, to repeat what I said. The point of our book, The Radical Center, is not to engage in that kind of sociological analysis. It's to suggest a practical program which would achieve what remain my goals, which are creating an America that's fair and dynamic. And it particularly addresses the interests of Americans who are left out by the present elite-dominated system. For example, contingent workers who don't get health benefits, kids from poor families or in poor geographic areas who were victimized by our system of school finance. So I see this as perfectly compatible. A number of our proposals, obviously, you know, you'd have to read the book to see. We can't go over the whole book in an hour. But every one of our proposals, we try to move away from a system rigged in favor of the already affluent to one that is more fair, while remaining our commitment to a dynamic market economy, which was also the commitment of New Deal liberals and progressives. They were not socialists. They wanted to have a flourishing market economy as well as generous entitlements. So I'll give you an example. One thing we propose is replacing the vast majority of tax loopholes, of tax expenditures, which almost by definition benefit very wealthy people. If you have a social program like the home mortgage interest deduction, which is limited to people who pay income tax, most working poor and poor people do not make enough money under the present tax system to pay income tax, so they're not eligible for it. At the same time, in some cases, the higher your income, the greater a tax subsidy you get from the government, which is just insane and immoral. So Ted Halstead and I in the Radical Center propose what we think is a very egalitarian approach to the tax code, where you eliminate you consolidate all of the existing tax loopholes for education, for housing, for other purposes, transportation, consolidate them into a handful of refundable tax credits that all people, including poor people, can get that will be in exactly the same amount for everybody, which obviously means much more to poor people than it does to wealthy people.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah, and you will have to be quick because we're pretty tight on time.
That sounded very good. But let me just quickly ask you, how does your foundation come down on the Executive Order 13233, which was trying to get rid of the Presidential Records Act, you know, making it very difficult to get a hold of Reagan's and this and both Bush's presidential records?
Our foundation has no party line. That's one of the reasons we're more dynamic than some of our competitors. That is, you know, people don't look over their shoulders. We have a number of fellows. We now have about 24 fellows who are completely free to write whatever they want. So we have no party line, and to my knowledge, no fellow has written about any of these things, and I'm not familiar with the issue, frankly. My own prejudice is in favor of declassifying material because classification, you know, tends to protect politicians and bureaucrats from embarrassment, and they use, you know, the public interest as an excuse. Having said that, I do think that in certain areas of foreign policy where you're dealing with material, even if it's 20 or 30 years ago, but you have, say, a foreign government official are still in power and could be subject to reprisal. You know, one of the dark sides of diplomacy is that you have to deal with very unsavory regimes, and there may be a case for keeping some things classified, you know, for 30 or 40 or even 50 years in very sensitive foreign policy areas. But certainly when it comes to domestic policy, you know, the there has to be a rebuttable presumption in favor of letting the republic see what, you know, our elected officials and the bureaucrats whom we pay are up to.
I'm going to try and get one more. We'll go here to line two. You've got to be real quick, though, caller, please.
Okay. Great topic, and I don't know which way you lean, but you're very moderate and well-spoken. My concern, and I'll just express my concern and listen to your answer, is the proportional representation as it currently stands leads to parties picking powerful politicians who aren't accountable to local electorates. So, at least in the European and like Canadian model. So, how would you make, as part of your proportional representation, how would people still be accountable to local electorates, which I think is the beauty of our American system? And thank you.
Okay. And Mr. Land, I give you about a minute.
Okay. Well, that's a very good question. There's a difference between choice voting systems or proportional representation systems that elect single individuals, for example, governors and presidents and even representatives, and those which elect whole teams of multiple members in multi-member legislative districts. We don't propose multi-member districts in the United States, although I think that is an idea that might come. What we propose is a system, instant runoff voting, for members of the House and the Senate, as well as for governors and presidents and mayors, which would create more support within that district for an individual who would have to get a majority of second choice as well as first choice votes to be elected in a three or four way race. But it would retain the American tradition of a single representative for a single district.
Well, there we'll have to leave it because we've used the time. Mr. Lind, we want to say thanks very much for talking with us. Our guest, Michael Lind, and along with Ted Halstead, they are the authors of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics. If you want to read the book, it's out now in bookstores. It is published by Doubleday.